From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, some migrant children are reunited with their parents. We'll hear from a Michigan attorney about the chaos of today for her client.
If he was not represented, he would be meandering around in the middle of Michigan without knowing the language, with a toddler.
Plus, the grassroots efforts to help these migrant families.
Parents have been deported without their children. The federal government isn't sure how they're going to find those parents again. This is beyond the scope of anything I ever imagined would happen in this country. And I cannot just sit by and do nothing.
Could the Trump trade war with Canada affect progress on the Gordie Howe Bridge?
What's going on now momentarily should not get in the way of a project that is very far down the road.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The outcry continues against the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy, which has led to separating children from their parents at our southern border. Later in the hour, we'll hear from two Michigan residents doing what they can to help.
I wanted to know if I could help somebody else. I just couldn't watch what was happening to these families and to these mothers. I mean, as a mother myself, I just couldn't look my children in the face. And know that this was happening.
But first, today is the court-ordered deadline for the Trump administration to reunite young migrant children, children under age 5, with their parents. These kids have been held by the government for weeks, even months, after being separated from their parents at the southern border because of the zero-tolerance policy. There are reports about 54 children across the country will be reunited with their parents today, some in Michigan. Abril Valdez is an attorney with the ACLU Michigan. She represents two dads from Honduras whose small children were taken from them at the border and have been in foster care since in Michigan. I spoke with her just about an hour ago as she waited for her clients and their children to be released.
It's been a chaotic day. We have been given the runaround of when and where our fathers are going to get reunited. We finally arrived at a nice field office in Grand Rapids, and the father and children have now been reunited, and we are awaiting their exit from the center. I have not been able to see my client. I have only been able to talk to them on the phone, and so we're hoping that they come out in the next 5 minutes with their babies.
How would you describe the way the federal government has handled this court-ordered reunification of these families with small children? I mean, is there a process? Do they have transportation, referrals of
no,
any kind?
Absolutely not. It's fly by the night. It's just chaotic and unorganized. I was told where my client was going to be an hour before he arrived in the middle of the state. If he was not represented, he would be meandering around in the middle of Michigan without knowing the language, with a toddler, with absolutely no resources, no driver's license, no money, no clothes on his back. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. They continue to traumatize these families this way.
What's ahead when these families come out now? What will you be doing with them and for them?
We're providing emergency housing, transitional housing, until their pending immigration case, but those details are still being worked out.
Do we know if the government, Abril, missed that court order deadline for any other families in Michigan? You're seeing your two clients reunited today, but do we know if there's still kids under age 5 in Michigan who have not yet been reunited?
There is a total of 8 children in Michigan. We know that one of the parents have already been deported. Out of those 8 children. So that means we have an orphan here in Michigan who's going to be in long-term foster care because they have no family to reunify with. And then out of those 7 left, we have 3 today being reunified, but the remaining, there has been no word on where, if they're going to transport their parents to Michigan, when and where that's taking place.
So just question marks.
Correct.
And we have thousands of kids around the country aged 5 and older still in government custody, maybe as many as 2,900 separated kids. And that deadline is July 27th. Do we have any idea, Abril, how many of these children are in Michigan?
I don't know how many are in Michigan. I believe it's about the 50s. about the just the total number of children that are in Michigan.
Do you have any feeling whether the government will have these older children reunited with their parents by that deadline?
I hope so. I mean, there's a federal judge, you know, court order, and I'm hoping that they abide and they use the same resources and the same time and energy that they put into separating these families. They put that same energy to reuniting them.
What is next here in Michigan? What are you watching for?
We're just vigilant on the next attack on our communities. Everything that has happened is just a target to separate families, from ending TPS to doing this to little ones to the Muslim ban. It just feels like we are consistently under attack.
What is it that you want people listening to you right now to really understand? You know these two fathers. You know the situations. What do you want people to grasp about the situation these folks are in?
I want them to just open their hearts and see this not from a legality perspective, because there's nothing illegal about seeking asylum, which is exactly what these parents did. They didn't break any law. They showed up at the border. They sought help from our government, and our government turned around and ripped their children away from them. And so if we just have a little empathy and actually see them as human beings, we will see how everybody, it's a bipartisan issue of how cruel this is. If anybody with a child can think of spending the next 3 months without knowing where their child is, whether they're healthy, whether they're still breathing, whether they're being cared for, I mean, that should devastate anyone. And so this is no way to treat any human being, regardless of what language they speak or what country they come from.
Abril, just so everyone's clear, what's the next legal step for your clients now that they're reunited with their children?
My clients will continue with their proceedings in immigration court.
Abril Valdez, who is an attorney with the ACLU Michigan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Things are moving ahead for the new bridge between Detroit and Windsor. Last week, a consortium of builders was chosen to construct the Gordie Howe International Bridge. But trade tensions between the U.S. and Canada are rising. And then there is the Maroon family, owner of the Ambassador Bridge, running a commercial on Fox and Friends aimed at an audience of one.
Dear Mr. President, there are two grand new bridges being proposed in Detroit between America and Canada.
Well, the commercial goes on to urge the president to block the Gordie Howe Bridge and clear the way for the Maroons to build their new bridge next to the Ambassador Bridge. So could President Trump, as a recent article by Chad Livengood in Crain's Detroit posited, delay or even scuttle plans for the new bridge? Let's turn now to Andy Doctoroff. He's a special projects advisor to Governor Snyder, Michigan's point person on the Gordie Howe International Bridge. Andy, welcome back to Stateside.
Hello. How are you today?
Great, and very happy to have you with us. Andy, let's start with these trade tensions between Washington and Ottawa. There was certainly no sign of any of this back on June 15th, 2012, when the governor signed the agreement to get this bridge underway. How concerned are you these trade tensions could impact the plans to proceed with the bridge?
We look at the trade tensions as momentary blips, meaning this bridge is something that is built for the long haul. It's a 125-year life, and it's going to exist and serve the economies of both countries for a long time. And we think that all of the decision makers appreciate that, and what's going on now momentarily should not get in the way of a project that is very far down the road.
Have you or have anyone in the governor's office had conversations with anyone in the Trump administration recently?
I'm not going to speculate about any type of conversations that people have had. What I can say is that the ad that you just ran is chalked with inaccuracies. They talk about that overseas steel might be used. They mention that this will be Canadian-owned, that it will employ Canadians, and all of those things are untrue. The fact is that the underlying crossing agreement clearly states that American and Canadian steel only can be used. This is jointly owned by Michigan and Canada. And thousands of Americans as well as Canadians will be employed on this job building the bridge. So the underlying premise of that ad that was intended to influence decision making is wrong, and it's wrong repeatedly.
How much does this still ongoing effort by the Maroons to scuttle the bridge, how concerned are you at this point?
Well, the only thing I can say to that is the Maroons have been opposed to this project for years and years and years, and they've tried a variety of things to scuttle the project, to kill it, in the form of, among other things, litigation, lobbying, and the like. And what we do is we just focus on doing our job. We focus on moving the bridge forward, and if their activities impact us, we address them. For instance, we've won court case after court case, and we expect to continue, again, moving this project through completion. And, of course, last week's announcement of the retention of the preferred proponent, Bridging North America, underscores that there's no stopping us. This is a full steam ahead project.
So I think I'm hearing you answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you envision, Andy, any scenario that would prevent construction of the Gordie Howe Bridge from starting later this year as planned? I mean, what would have to happen to delay things?
I strongly believe that construction of this bridge will happen very soon. We will have a groundbreaking very soon. And that's a belief that is reinforced every day in my mind as I work on this project every day, and I'm very close to it.
When you say very soon, can you give us a sense when you expect groundbreaking to happen and construction to begin?
Not at this point, other than to say I expect it within the near term very soon.
Andy Doctoroff is Governor Snyder's special projects advisor, and he is Michigan's point person on the Gordie Howe Bridge. Andy, thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Coming up, we highlight some of the very best theater happening around the state this month, including a timely lineup at the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Plus, the Detroit Concert celebrating cultural diversity through music kicks off a sister festival in Jackson.
No matter what you look like, what you feel like, what your background is, what your religion is, you come together and dance and get to know each other and enjoy each other's cultures.
That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for us to tour around the state and see what professional theater companies are offering for their summer audiences. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here now, and we get to start out on a Mel Brooks note here, beginning with the Penny Seats Theater in Ann Arbor.
Yeah, the weather's been so spectacular, and it's great. And so this week, the Penny Seats opens up Young Frankenstein, the musical, in West Park, which, of course, is the Mel Brooks musical based on the movie. And I should say that musicals in the park can sometimes be a little problematic because of the sound system. I know this having done Urinetown myself in West Park. But I saw The Gravedigger, which they did last month, was really impressed with the quality of the sound design for that play. So bring your lawn chairs and water bottles starting this Thursday at West Park, and that's accessed off South 7th in Ann Arbor.
All right, so Young Frankenstein. Then over to Farmer's Alley. Where's that?
That is in Kalamazoo, and they're doing their own Mel Brooks tribute, The Producers.
Oh,
now,
my.
I love this show. I have very high hopes for that Farmer's Alley will do it well. They've put on some pretty tricky shows of late and done each one very well. And for those who may not be familiar, this show started out as a movie, I think around 1968.
Yeah. Gene Wilder.
With Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel.
Yeah.
It's about a failing Broadway producer and his accountant who try to put on a guaranteed flop of a play called Springtime for Hitler. And the comedy ensues when it actually becomes a hit and their scheme to defraud the investors goes south. It was adapted as a musical for Broadway, and then the musical became a film. obviously, it's just a hilarious Brooks story that has so much universal appeal that it keeps getting adapted all these different ways.
It's so funny. And then, of course, that Broadway original cast with Matthew Broderick and Nathan Lane.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
And then
goodness.
They made a movie out of that. Yeah.
So let's just take a quick listen to the Broadway soundtrack. Here's some of Springtime for Hitler.
Deutschland is happy and gay. We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for...
And the irony of this is particularly rich when you consider before he became known to the world as Mel Brooks, Melvin Kaminsky served in the U.S. Army in World War II, 78th Infantry Division. He defused landmines as the Allies advanced into Germany. Just tuck that under your head as you think of seeing the producers. Now we head to the to Tipping Point in Northville.
Right. They have a play, a little more on the serious side, called The Impossibility of Now. And that opens up July 19th. And it's about a science writer who has a freak accident that leaves him with amnesia. And then his wife helps him to pick up the pieces to rediscover a life he may not want to face exactly. Again, serious stuff. It reminds me a bit of the Harrison Ford film, if you've seen it, Regarding Henry.
I do remember that. He is shot in a holdup attempt and has to basically rediscover his whole life.
Right. The cast is wonderful. Features some of our best talent around. Alex Liedenfrost, who runs the theater program at Pioneer High School. His real-life wife, Julia Glander, who's an excellent actress in her own right. And Dave Davies, who, again, one of the most celebrated actors we have in Michigan.
So you're feeling good about this cast.
Yes, feeling very good.
Now we head to West Michigan, over to Holland, Michigan Hope Summer Rep.
Right. They are doing some wonderful work this summer, I have to say. And they also just got a bunch of Wild Awards from Wild nominations from us for its season last year. And they're doing Godspell, which, of course, good crowd pleaser. Everybody knows what Godspell's about. And that opens on the 20th.
And this is just a little bit of the best-known number from Godspell. This is Robin Lamont from the original off-Broadway cast.
Day by day. Day by day, oh dear Lord, three things I pray: to see thee more clearly, love thee more dearly, follow thee more dearly, day by day.
And now on to the Bard, the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, opening this coming weekend?
Right. They are opening their first play with The Tempest. This is actually Shakespeare's last play, believed to be his last play that he wrote on his own. It's also one of my favorites. And if you haven't been to the festival, which has performances first at Jackson Community College's excellent theater and then at the Village Theater in Canton, I highly recommend catching The Tempest at either venue. Both these theaters are excellent, comfortable, and let's face it, Michigan Shakespeare Festival never disappoints.
Long track record.
Yeah. And I spoke with the festival's director, Janice Blix, this week about the season that kicks off with The Tempest, and then it also includes Measure for Measure and another play called The Rover.
You can seldom say that Shakespeare is ripped from the headlines, but it really feels that way. What we were playing with was setting up the argument of power and how you get power and how you hold on to power. And that is one of the major themes behind The Tempest. And then last fall, you know, the Me Too movement started and all of the allegations are coming out about powerful men. And that's one of the central storylines of Measure for Measure, sexual harassment and the abuse of power. And then our third show, we always do a third show that's not Shakespeare, but is a classical work. And I ended up choosing Aphra Behn because it's a pretty well-known one, and it's a comedy, and it is set in Carnival, and she wrote it in 1667. And it's kind of fun to say, hey, in case you didn't know, there were women who wrote during the Restoration. And so when we put the season together, I didn't have an agenda on board, but I liked the exploration of these different areas of government and power and gender and history. And that's how our season got created.
All right. So that's what we've got coming from the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Now we end up at the Williamston Theater, and you seem to be really intrigued by this comedy they're doing.
Yes. It's a play called Memoir. And it's about the legendary actress Sarah Bernhardt. For those not in the know about her, she was a French actress in the 19th century and early 20th, and was, if I can make this comparison, she was pretty much the Meryl Streep of her day. She was known the world over, even in those days, because she traveled around so much. And in fact, she's more than the Meryl Streep of her day. It's more like the Streep, Katharine Hepburn, and Patti LuPone, if you can imagine, all rolled into this one incredible talent. So I'm really intrigued to see this play about her life. She's not forgotten among theater nerds, but she lived so long ago, she died in the 20s, that most people, you know, don't really remember her stuff. So I'm very intrigued by this play.
And it's a comedy.
And it's billed as a comedy.
Interesting,
yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, certainly we have musicals and Shakespeare and Theater in the Park. So a lot of good stuff to enjoy through summertime in Michigan. And you can get the details of these and other productions. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, many thanks.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. This week brings the 26th go-round, that's 26, for Detroit's Concert of Colors, presented by the Arab American National Museum. It starts tomorrow, runs through Sunday, celebrating cultural diversity through music, the spoken word, and so much more. The Concert of Colors has inspired a sister festival in Jackson. It's called the Jackson Unity Festival. Here with us now is the founder of the Concert of Colors, Ishmael Ahmed. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And from the Michigan Theater in Jackson, it's a pleasure to welcome Steve Tucker. Hey, Steve.
Hi, how are you, Cynthia?
Very good. So glad to talk about this with both of you. Ishmael, take us back 26 years and tell us just what drove you to launch the Concert of Colors.
The Concert of Colors was started by a group in Detroit called New Detroit, and it grew out of the Race Relations Committee, who wanted to bring together people from the communities of color to celebrate their cultures, both traditional and experimental, and then bring the rest of Detroit to enjoy that. But it's grown since then, so we present all cultures, and we have a big focus on the music of Detroit in particular. It was supposed to be, and it really has become, a place where no matter what you look like, what you feel like, what your background is, what your religion is, you come together and dance and get to know each other and enjoy each other's cultures. So we have music from all over the world and a lot of music from Detroit as well.
And you have more than music. Give us a sense of some of the other things being offered.
Yeah, well, poetry. There'll be a youth poetry slam and also some other poets. There'll be dance, several readings, all kinds of things. And, of course, there'll be children's area and makers doing things, and the list goes on and on. And also lots of community groups will be out there letting people know about the things they're doing to improve their communities.
So, and this year, a sister festival. Steve, what inspired the Jackson Unity Festival?
Ishmael did. I went last year to the 25th, and because I had some time, I was born and raised near Detroit and in Detroit proper. So I went to the festival and saw the review, the Don Was review. And at the end of the evening, Ishmael got up on stage and talked a little bit about it. I thought, like, this is perfect for Jackson. Jackson's sort of on the upswing right now. You know, we've battled back from abject poverty and finally passed the NDO, the non-discrimination order, in 2017. We have a young mayor who was really interested in doing this diversity festival, and I called Ishmael about 2 weeks after festival in Detroit, the Concert of Colors, and we met, and then we met again, and he said, okay. So that was a wonderful thing, and it's going to be a great thing for Jackson.
And being the first time out for Jackson, how are you working this out as far as sharing performers and sharing the acts? How are things going to be divvied up?
Well, Ishmael was kind enough to let us get on board and hire the musicians for it instead of coming to Michigan, because they're coming from all over the planet. Instead of just doing one show while they were here, they did two shows. I think we each got a little bit of a break financially. It's logistically, it's been it's complex for us. We're a small group. It's just the DDA, Nate Mack from the DDA, and Steve Trozen from the Jackson Symphony that are the partners. It's been a little bit of a logistic issue, but we're hammering it out, and we're going to be ready. So if there's a band on Sunday in Detroit, they're going to perform on Saturday in Jackson. So the five different groups he has on Sunday are going to be in Jackson on Saturday. And homologous to that is the Sunday performance. The Saturday performance will be the Sunday performance here. So if they're in Detroit on Sunday, they're in Jackson on Saturday. If they're in Detroit on Saturday, they're in Jackson on Sunday.
So it's clear you are really drawing in artists from all over the world. Buffy St. Marie, who has been a figurehead since the 60s, prominent Native American singer-songwriter. You're going to have Dr. Mona Hanna-Hatisha is going to be there, talking keynote speaker, and talking about her book on the Flint water crisis. You've got Hades Ram. You've got from England, Trans Global Underground. And then, of course, the 11th Don was Detroit All-Star Review brings all kinds of Detroit rockers together. You've got poet Jessica Kerr Moore. And then, of course, from Flint, Tunde Olaniran is going to be performing in Detroit and in Jackson. All of these acts are really terrific. I'm interested, I'm going to start with you, Ishmael. When Steve reached out to you and said, I want to do this in Jackson, what did you think?
I love it. I mean, we couldn't have anything better happen. We want to spread this idea that we all should live and work together. And it's a time when we need to be spreading that idea. And so we were thrilled to have Jackson and Steve in particular on board, because he's been so great to work with.
What do you see, Ishmael, as the issues in Jackson that are you share in common, that you're addressing, that you share in the Detroit area as well?
Well, I think racism is still alive and well. I think that many of the communities of color are under attack, the Latino community, the Arab community. We still have a division. We live and work in, you know, separate places. And so the ability to get to know and trust each other and to work with each other is still an issue. And the Concert of Colors helps make that happen in a non-threatening way.
And Steve, your thoughts, the issues that you think you share in common, that you and Jackson share with the Detroit area?
Well, I think abject poverty is a common problem, and, structural racism, the same things that are happening in Detroit, but our population density is much smaller. You know, we're a much smaller city. So we suffer the same things, and we're also the same kind of city that is trying to change things around. We have some political heft behind us. The mayor, Derek Dobies, the city council, they're all behind everything we're doing here. And Ishmael's vision was so clear at the time when I first met him. I thought, like, oh, this is something we just have to do because we're ready. We need it. The one thing that, Cynthia, that neither of us has spoken about yet was that everything is free to every person. There are no ticket sales. Everything is free.
You want people to come and hear this and be together.
Exactly. We want everybody to be active and participate in this major event for us.
As they say, the Concert of Colors has the whole world in its bands. There are all kinds of venues, all kinds of acts, starting tomorrow, running through Sunday. So we have the links for more information at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. The 26th Concert of Colors and the very first Jackson Unity Festival. And it's been a pleasure talking with Ishmael Ahmed and, from Jackson, Steve Tucker. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Adventure lovers, step right up. Michigan's longest zip line opens this Saturday at Camp Dearborn in Milford. You will be able to climb to the top of a six-story tower, get buckled into your rig, and zip. According to the camp, riders can hit speeds up to 35 miles an hour along the 1,436-foot ride. It'll take you right over the lake and land you on the main beach. Depending upon the winds, the ride will last about 40 seconds. Camp Dearborn has installed two lines, one for riders weighing 75 to 235 pounds, and the second line for folks weighing in between 100 and 285 pounds. Now, this isn't the only zip line in Michigan, but it will be the longest. Still to come, we'll get details about the grassroots efforts to help migrant families. And then insurance companies, they base their business on figuring out and minimizing risk. So why not ask about gun ownership?
Actuaries and insurers have not studied the risk. They've not quantified the risk. To the best of our knowledge, this has not been systematically studied.
That is in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The plight of the migrant families separated at our southern border has energized grassroots efforts to help. Two of those volunteer helpers are here with us now. Rabbi Josh Winston is from Temple Beth Emeth in Ann Arbor. He began the Facebook group Migrant Mother Drivers. Rosalie Lochner is a stay-at-home mom from Grosse Pointe Park. Rosalie, I understand you're preparing for the families whose children were released today in Grand Rapids, and they're going to be arriving in Detroit later today. What have you been doing?
Yeah, we're running around, doing as much as we can. We're preparing bedrooms, getting toys, clothes, lining up people to help with interpretation because we don't know what languages people will be speaking. We're kind of just running around trying to cover all the bases right now. Their arrival.
And the plan is that they're going to come to the Detroit area.
To the Detroit area, yep.
And so you're trying to just bring a welcoming amount of things that they're going to need. And you're part of this grassroots group called Michigan Support Circle that's popped up in recent weeks. Tell us about this group. How many members? What you're doing?
Sure. We have about 30 members. We are a product of another group that Immigrant Families Together, which was helping to bring moms from detention centers in Arizona to their families in New York and Florida. And we thought this was a great idea to do in Michigan. So we branched off from Immigrant Families Together in order to focus on families in Michigan.
And certainly the plight of Yenny Gonzalez is something that animated you, didn't it?
Absolutely. That's how I got connected to the Immigrant Families Together Facebook group. I wanted to know if I could help somebody else. I just couldn't watch what was happening to these families and to these mothers. I mean, as a mother myself, I just couldn't look my children in the face and know that this was happening.
And Rabbi Winston, here, speaking of Yenny Gonzalez, last week you actually helped to drive her part of the way. She had to journey from Arizona to New York to be reunited with her children. And her story got a lot of national attention.
Yeah.
Tell us, what did you learn about her as you drove her on the leg from Ann Arbor to Pittsburgh?
I learned that she's from a small village in Guatemala, that it's controlled basically by a gang, that she was reluctant to leave her house, reluctant to let her children leave her house, that she was afraid that her 11-year-old son was probably either going to be killed by the gang or recruited by them, one or the other, and that's why she ventured north and took a bus from Guatemala up through Mexico and into the United States. And you know, one of the things that surprised me, just because so much of the news coverage has been talking to migrants who say, regardless of the policy, I would still be coming. She said the exact opposite. She said that had I known what was going to happen to me and my family, I would not have done this. And that was reported on earlier this week that she had said that, and it was shocking to hear that that it's been that bad compared to gangs that would kill her children.
And I know out of your effort, you started a Facebook group called Migrant Mother Drivers. Tell us about this group.
So very similar to what we've already heard, you know, because I was involved with driving any and told the folks that helped to arrange that I would be happy to continue helping. I got text message this weekend from Megan Finn, who's an Ann Arbor native but lives in New York, who helped organize this. And I couldn't drive on Monday, but I wanted to bring people together that would be willing to. And when people heard that I had driven, in particular friends of mine and members of my congregation, they were very interested in helping as well. So I put together the Facebook group, and we drove another woman yesterday, past Monday.
You want to have a network. You want to have some bench strength. So yeah. If a driver's needed, you'll be able to provide it.
And translators, too, by the way.
And translators.
Yes.
What is it, Rabbi, about the plight of Yeni and these other immigrant families that has moved you this deeply?
Similarly, that I'm a parent, I have three children, and I can't imagine what it would be like to have committed a misdemeanor offense, which Yeni did, and have my children ripped from my hands. You know, people keep talking about separation. This is stealing. The government is stealing children from their parents. And as we've learned in the past few days, parents have been deported without their children. The federal government isn't sure how they're going to find those parents again. This is beyond the scope of anything I ever imagined would happen in this country. And I cannot just sit by and do nothing.
And Rosalie, what about you? What really calls to your heart?
I think the rabbi just basically covered it. The fact that these children and these parents did not know where they were, like they could not reach each other, that they could not connect, that these children were being flown around the country. I mean, I look at my children and I cannot imagine that happening to my family. And I cannot imagine sitting by and watching that happen to somebody else's family. I felt called upon as a citizen of this country to act in any way that I could.
I'm wondering, I know, Rabbi, you have three young children. They're all under 8. How do you talk to your kids about this? Are you getting questioned?
My 8-year-old is curious, and she's been fearful for a while. She knows that she's different as a Jewish person than some of her other classmates. She's fearful for her classmates who are of color. She's fearful, you know, wondering if because she's Jewish, if something will happen to her. And this is not something that I've ever talked to her about. She brought it to us, so she's been asking questions about this for some time. And I think, you know, I was reluctant to talk to her about what I did last Monday. Reluctant, to be honest with you, to talk to anybody about it. I didn't want it to. I did it because it felt like the least I could do, right? It's just the least I can do in this situation. I drove somebody. I spent a few hours on the road. It's nothing. And
so why did you decide, yes, you will talk about it?
Because I talked to some congregants about it, and they were upset that I hadn't said anything. And so I thought, okay, I'll be more public about this. And it's been good. It meant that I was able to help this past Monday.
And Rosalie, what about you? Plans going forward? How do you want to stay involved in what is happening with these migrant families?
Well, right now we have lawyers calling us for further assistance, so we're working with them. We're going to provide whatever support we can for these families, whether they need to move on to other places or if they're settling here, so that they feel like they have a support network at their hands. Since they've been moved to new places, they don't necessarily have contacts. Now, they've got this immense trauma on top of all of the other trauma that they've had to deal with that they now have to work through. So the goal here is to make these families feel as supported as possible.
Rosalie Lochner is a stay-at-home mom from Grosse Pointe Park who right now is preparing to welcome with supplies and everything needed for families who were reunited in Grand Rapids today. They'll be arriving in Detroit later today. And Rabbi Josh Winston from Temple Beth Emeth in Ann Arbor, who began the Facebook group Migrant Mother Drivers. Thank you so much to both of you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosalie.
Thank you.
Insurance companies base their business on looking for ways to minimize risk. For example, a life insurance company will ask whether you scuba dive or whether you smoke cigarettes. But as a researcher from the University of Michigan points out, insurance companies do not ask whether you own a gun. Kristen Moore is an associate professor of mathematics at U of M in Ann Arbor. She co-authored a piece for The Actuary magazine exploring the insurance perspective of owning a firearm. And she is with us now. It's good to have you back on Stateside, Kristen.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
So just to get everybody crystal clear on just what an actuary does, briefly explain that to us.
Okay, so actuaries specialize in measuring and managing risk, quantifying risk. So what actuaries try to do, the way I would explain it to a prospective student, is they try to put a value in today's dollars on an uncertain future outcome. The most basic actuarial math 101 question is, suppose you have a group of 1,000 people and you want to pay out a death benefit to each of them of $1 million at their time of death. How much should you collect from them today so that you can pay out those payments at an uncertain time in the future?
So you're looking at behaviors and factors in their life that contribute risk.
Right.
And trying to crunch those numbers and to put that into numbers.
Right. Actuaries use math, statistics, and finance to figure out the cost today of uncertain, risky things in the future.
So all these actuaries are hard at work for insurance companies,
right,
helping to underwrite people's policies. So what kinds of factors are considered when assessing risk for insurance purposes? I mean, give us some examples. You mentioned as one, scuba diving.
Right. So if you apply for a life insurance policy, the insurance company will do some underwriting, meaning they'll examine what kind of risk you are. So depending on the size of the policy, they might just ask, you know, have you fill out a questionnaire. But for a larger policy, there might be a medical exam, medical tests, and they will ask about your profession, about your hobbies. Do you engage in risky avocations such as private aviation, rock climbing, scuba diving? And they'll also want to know, are you a smoker? Are you overweight? Maybe do you have a history of heart disease in your family?
How does firearm risk compare to those other factors?
Well, that's really the question. First of all, there's not a lot in the literature about how firearm risk compares to scuba diving or private aviation. To the best of my knowledge, it has not been studied. But we looked at just, you know, did some estimates of death rates, the death rate attributable to scuba diving versus firearms. And we found actually that the death rate attributable to firearm ownership is actually higher than the death rate attributable to scuba diving. And so then it's natural to ask, why are insurance companies asking about the one and not the other?
Because even with all these specific and very personal questions insurance companies ask, you dug around and found many do not ask about gun ownership. Just how prevalent is this practice of not asking someone about whether they own a gun?
To the best of my knowledge, they do not ask in life insurance underwriting or in homeowners
across underwriting. Across the board.
To the best of our knowledge, yes.
So why do you think they don't ask about gun ownership? I mean, if smoking or having a backyard pool could be risk factors, it would seem like owning a gun would be considered a pretty obvious one, no? I mean, what's the reasoning, do you think?
Well, so when you decide what factors you want to consider, you want to know how material is the risk. How risky is it? Is it likely to generate claims? So is the risk material? But then there are also social and political forces. There are some marketing. For example, there could be factors that you would underwrite on that are predictive of risk, but may alienate a segment of your market.
And this is what an interpretation you have as to why we're not seeing that question asked?
Right. I think it's currently not asked first because actuaries and insurers have not studied the risk. They've not quantified the risk. To the best of our knowledge, this has not been systematically studied. But then on top of that, it may not be palatable to segments of their market. Now, I believe that when smoker and non-smoker mortality was first introduced, that was probably controversial too. I imagine that smokers were pretty angry that they were getting an unfavorable insurance rating and premium increases.
We've traveled a long way since the 60s, haven't we?
Yes,
since
we
the
have.
Surgeon General's report
right.
on smoking. What kinds of insurance might be affected by gun ownership?
That's a really good question. So obviously, life insurance and health insurance. Those are the two most obvious. But also, homeowners, commercial liability, and disability may also be affected.
Now, I know that you've been involved in advocating for more gun legislation in the past. Does this article that you've co-authored for the Actuary Magazine support that advocacy? I mean, what kind of stance are you taking with this research?
Right. So in the paper, we deliberately don't take any stance on policy issues. What we do in the paper is we present some data, we focus on associated insurance risks, and we call for more research. We absolutely do not take a policy position.
What is your call to action to actuaries and to the insurance industry?
So in the paper, we outlined three important research questions. And I would really like to see an actuarial or insurer working groups form to start digging into this. I think one of the first things to start looking at is, let's track claims. How many claim dollars are being paid out? Now, I know that insurance organizations are meticulously tracking the number of claims and dollar value of claims for dog bites. If they can track it for dog bites, why are we not tracking it for gunshot wounds?
So that would be one.
Right. There are many studies on the costs related to gun violence, but they're always a single snapshot of the treatment, maybe the first encounter in the emergency department or an inpatient hospitalization. To the best of my knowledge, nobody has looked longitudinally at lifetime costs for non-fatal gunshot wounds. I imagine that the health insurance impact may be huge. But we don't know because nobody studied it. And presumably, insurers have the data to be able to track costs, follow cases longitudinally. And so I think that's an important area for study.
And this third question you have?
The third question would be similar to smoker, non-smoker mortality. In survey papers, other authors have noted that there really aren't cohort studies. Let's look at the mortality experience of gun owners versus non-gun owners. Or let's look at the mortality experience for gun owners and compare it to standard mortality rates in a state or a region. And then determine, is there a significant mortality differential, just as people studied for smoker and non-smoker mortality?
So what do you think this would mean, Kristen, just in practical terms? If more insurance companies went ahead and considered gun ownership as a risk factor, how might this affect people really on a practical level?
The answer might be not at all. The first thing we have to do is measure the risk. How significant is it? If the risk is infinitesimal, then maybe you don't want to consider it in insurance underwriting at all. But if the risk is significant, then maybe insurers would decide to use firearm ownership as an underwriting factor in, for example, life insurance and homeowners insurance. And then if you owned a gun, perhaps there would be a premium increase on your life insurance or your homeowners, but maybe there could be premium incentives to encourage safer behavior, such as safe storage practices. But again, we don't know if any of that would play out before we first measure the risk.
All right. So that's the call from this piece by Kristen Moore, Associate Professor of Mathematics at the University of Michigan. Her piece was co-authored for The Actuary Magazine, exploring the insurance perspective of owning a firearm. Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you for having me.
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
Am I curious?
There is so much to talk about in this diverse state we live in. We can't possibly know about it all, and that is where you come in. We want to know what you're curious about. If you have a question about Michigan, something or somebody you've always wondered about, send that question along. Just go to the Am I Curious page at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Sam Corey, Joey Horan, Gabrielle Horton, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.